The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
A very warm welcome back to Tech Weekly with me, Alex Krotowski. On this week's show...
So women are getting 13% of the computer science degrees in the United States, down from 35% in 1985. Women are getting 18% of the degrees here. That's not enough.
We have an exclusive interview with one of the most powerful figures in the global digital industry. COO, that's Chief Operating Officer of Facebook, Sheryl Sandberg, speaks to Guardian Head of Technology, Jemima Kish, about her book, Lean In, Women, Work, and the Will to Lead. Also, I'll be joined by the tech team to discuss the growing influence of Chinese technology companies. And has Marissa Mayer turned Yahoo around? Stay tuned for the answer. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Joining me in the studio this week is The Guardian's head of technology, Jemima Kish.
Hello.
Hi, Jemima. And also The Guardian's telecoms correspondent, Juliet Garside.
Hello.
Hi, Juliet. Welcome to you both. And we're all dot London today.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Do we all feel a bit dot London?
Ish. Yeah.
Well, there we go. We kick off with news that the Chinese e-commerce group Alibaba is heading for a flotation on the New York Stock Exchange. And this is not too far away from the very recent Weibo float. Now, two flotations do not make a trend, but Juliet, these two are no ordinary companies. Are we seeing the rise of the Far East tech giants?
Yeah, we've seen a few arrive already and speculation that more may be coming. Obviously, Alibaba this week is the big news. And there's another interesting company called Xiaomi, which makes handsets, smartphone handsets, and a lot of software to go with it. Now, they outsold Samsung and Apple handsets in China in December. They sold about 20 million handsets last year. They've got a target of 40 million this year, so it's powering ahead. No sign of an entire Xiaomi IPO yet, but they have a subsidiary that does software, and one of the bits of software that they do is the CleanMaster app, and it wipes all the junk files off your Android phone, and it is one of the most popular non-gaming downloads in the Play Store. And this part of the business, along with other bits of it that do IT security software, has filed for an IPO in the States, and that should be coming along quite soon. So it will be a chance at buying a small nibble of the Xiaomi empire, but I think there's more to come potentially from them.
What's interesting about all of these companies, and we've mentioned three, we've got Xiaomi, we've got Alibaba, and we've got Weibo, is that they're all floating in the US stock market. Mm. Is that correct?
Yes.
Why is this?
Well, quite a few of the current generation of big IT companies floated some years ago in Hong Kong. So the company that owns WeChat, called Tencent, is actually listed in Hong Kong already. But I think they're being attracted by the kind of valuations we've seen for Twitter, that we've seen for Facebook. And also, it is a kind of bulwark against state interference. Alibaba had to go through a very careful process of negotiation to justify US IPO. So initially, the partners, such as Jack Ma, wanted the freedom to appoint board directors, and that was a freedom the Hong Kong Stock Exchange wouldn't allow. So the obvious next step was to go to the States.
There is a very commercial imperative here as well, that the US has a very significant market. It's not as big as China. But Jack Ma described the US e-commerce market as being like a dessert, whereas in China it's kind of a three-course meal because that's the primary way that people buy and kind of engage with retail. So the potential there for growth is absolutely vast, and that's very much another reason why these sites are interested in growing in the US.
So before we get into more of the macro observations about what's happening in China right now, I want to drill down a little bit on the two flotations that we one that we saw recently and one that we're expecting this week. Juliet, tell me a little bit about who Weibo is and why this company has been so successful.
Weibo is like the Chinese Twitter. It's a microblogging platform, and Alibaba actually owns a third of it. And it's very successful in China because short multiple conversations are a really good way of getting around the censors. So it's a freedom of expression platform as much as anything. It IPO'd last week. Had been hoping to raise $500 million in the States and ended up slashing that quite a lot. I think $280 million was roughly what they raised in the end. There were fears that censorship might damage the business. There were fears that there might be other competitors on the horizon. And also it was IPOing in the middle of a tech bubble wobble. King had had a bit of a disaster with its IPO. Anyway, in the end, the fears, I think the caution paid off, perhaps not for the company's original investors just yet, but the shares popped on Friday. They were up and again on Monday. So confidence is returning to the sector, I think, as a whole for now, but also to Weibo.
Jemima, you mentioned the difference between the US stock market and also the Hong Kong stock market. Obviously, a company that's coming out of the East, that's coming out of China, would have a sort of a PR uphill climb, I would argue, in the US. How have they managed to raise even as much as Juliet described?
Well, Xiaomi, just on a kind of on the PR tip, I suppose, just today, Hugo Barra, who they poached as the one of the head of Androids at Google, said they're changing their name to Mi, which is interesting because I think a lot of Western languages would struggle to pronounce a word with an X in it. So it's a small but significant shift for them in making their business more global. Xiaomi has about 500 million users already, and that's without even making much of an inroad in Western markets. It's a very aggressive company, and their sites, as well as those of Alibaba and Weibo, will be set on the US, where the market there for e-commerce alone actually is nearly 265 billion for 2013. And that's only going to grow by nearly 14% a year. So if the US companies aren't as aggressive and they don't have the scale of Alibaba, which is an amazing company that kind of does what eBay and Amazon does together.
Four out of every $5 spent on e-commerce in China, I think, goes to an Alibaba site.
Oh, well, there you go. And has 800 million users. Mm. So the numbers here very quickly get so large, they are almost incomprehensible. But these companies are very aggressive and very well organized, and a lot of their Western rivals are going to have some intense competition on their hands.
Juliet, we've had a little taste test of what Alibaba is. It's a kind of eBay plus Amazon combined. Can you describe a little bit more about who they are? Because I imagine we'll be hearing more about them over the next coming week and in the future.
Yeah, I mean, essentially they're a business. The main Alibaba platform, there are several. There are ones that do what Amazon does, so straight retail. There are others that do auction of personal goods. But the Alibaba platform sells goods made by manufacturers to perhaps retailers or other manufacturers. It's a business-to-business website. And it's really risen on the back of China's manufacturing boom over the last 20 years. It's a way for small producers to get in touch with small retailers. So, you know, if you're buying goods from a shop, from a newsagent's here, you know, that newsagent's chain may have bought its goods from a Chinese manufacturer via Alibaba.
They're expected to float this week. In fact, by the time you hear this, they may have already floated. Juliet, what can we expect to see? What do we expect to see their valuation at?
Sky high valuations. $150 billion is probably a conservative estimate. I mean, it may go up, but given the recent tech wobble, they may choose to stay conservative. That's not much less than what Facebook's currently trading at, just to give you a comparison. So Facebook is trading at just under $160 billion, and they will raise quite a lot of cash from this. They'll raise $15 billion is the current estimate. And that's for a company founded 15 years ago.
How much would you say, Juliet, China is innovating when it comes to their technology and their technology companies, their e-commerce companies?
I think that the claims that the Chinese do often copy technologies, websites, smartphones available in the West are probably fairly founded. What China's been able to do, though, is iterate quickly, and develop platforms or technologies using manufacturing manpower that comes more cheaply. And so it's a kind of popularization of perhaps privileged goods and services and an experience of a mass market, one of the world's biggest mass market.
One of the advantages that China and Chinese manufacturing companies have is that they have a more direct path than many other Western tech companies to the manufacturing itself, because a lot of the product breakthroughs, as we learnt from the Jony Ive biography recently, are dependent not on sort of, you know, blue sky thinking and some kind of design concept. They're dependent on a manufacturing breakthrough.
So, Juliet, beyond the companies that we've spoken about already, whether it's WeChat and Tencent or Saber or Weibo or Xiaomi, and obviously Alibaba, who else is interesting to watch? What personalities should we be paying attention to in China?
Well, it's the internet entrepreneurs. It's people like Lei Jun of Xiaomi, Ren Zhengfei of Huawei, Jack Ma of Alibaba. So these are, Ren is slightly older generation, but these are entrepreneurs who really are the kind of heroes of the post-cultural revolution generation, because they were operating in a sphere that government had limited control and understanding over. And they were able to gain cultural freedoms, but also business freedom as business leaders that people in other spheres didn't have. And so they are not quite countercultural, but they are seen as a strong balance to the government. And I think Jack Ma's saying is that you should love the government. He tells the staff you should love the government but never marry the government. And he's rejected multiple approaches for state ownership.
Yeah, it's another small point that also what these services represent to this whole new generation of younger, wealthier, middle-class Chinese is it's their first opportunity to express themselves. They're not only allowed to, but they can. And there's not been much precedent in China for that, as we know.
For more coverage on this story and everything that's happening in the Chinese tech industry, don't forget to go to theguardian.com/technology. Now, as we mentioned, one of Chinese tech's profitable partnerships has been Yahoo and Alibaba. And for Yahoo, this profit has played a particularly significant role in its first quarter profits. They're up modestly, but with the stock markets appeased, it seems a good time to ask. Has Yahoo's CEO, Marissa Mayer, managed to turn things around? Jemima, the introduction there suggests that that Marissa was in charge of a sinking ship when she took the helm. Tell me what the circumstances were of that transfer of power and what Yahoo looked like at that time.
I think Marissa Mayer was a rising star at Google. She'd been a proven executive and she'd impressed a lot of people. I think she was about 20th Googler through the door or something. So a lot of people were very surprised when she went to Yahoo. But I think what it gave her was that Yahoo was in such a bad way that it would have been pretty difficult for her not to make some kind of impact. What she has managed to do is, it's quite remarkable, really. She's not only re-motivated the staff in the company, because she said that people was her priority above all. She's not only re-motivated the staff and brought on new talent, but she's also managed to return to this previously disastrous strategy of Yahoo being a media company. And she's brought in food bloggers. She set up a new tech site, which is very good, led by David Pogue. There have been some very high-profile acquisitions. She bought Sumly, with the British news startup, and Rockmelt, Tumblr, most notably, $1.1 billion. So she's made some huge status purchases. She's remotivated staff. She's built a strategy which investors and staff and evidently users seem to like, and these financials really seem to show that, ironically, revenues were the last priority on her list after people, products and traffic, but she seems to have done it, and good on her.
Internally, she made some very very dramatic changes quite early on, and the most dramatic change, I think, came within days of her announcing that she was coming in, which was this idea that employees could not work from home. They could not take their laptops home. Do you think that was part of her people strategy or her product strategy or her traffic strategy?
Maybe all of them. I don't know. I feel like that was a bit... there was a little bit of character assassination going on there at the time. And she's a very assertive, extremely successful woman. And I do think that women take more flack in senior positions, which we will go on to talk about in a moment. But I think she has a point. And we know this at The Guardian. Obviously, we publish a vast website of 100 million page views a month. But I think every digital business will see the same thing, that it doesn't matter how digital you are or what your product is. You work with people and you create a product together. And that product is the result of, you know, all the people that you know and you work with working together. And you work better when you have good relationships with the people you work with.
Juliet, to what degree can we claim that that this upswing is due to Marissa's interventions?
Would Yahoo's revenue be up 1%? Would its display revenue be up 2%? I mean, this, I would describe these figures as a stabilization rather than kind of transformation of the company. But it comes from an upbeat mood and perhaps a settling down in the technology revolution. You know, mobile has arrived and it's done a lot of the damage that it was going to do to traditional website traffic. I'm sure it'll carry on, but the pain has been felt.
The contrast from a few years ago is just staggering. I remember having a cup of coffee with a VC who was, this was probably about 2009, 2010, who was utterly convinced that some investors were going to move in, take control of the company, sell off all the bits that were vaguely of interest, Flickr and all the rest, and wring the company for its advertising business. Every last penny of revenue would be wrung out of the company and then it would be wound down. It seemed almost inevitable.
It truly did. And after a series of disastrous CEOs arriving and then departing, Marissa was a kind of island amongst us. There was so much hope that was surrounding her. So you can see why it would become infectious.
I think what people forget actually, I think what people in the tech industry forget is that to the broader world, to the big consumer world, it's not an early adopter product. It doesn't have to be cool in the tech industry to be a very successful business. And they built their business primarily off advertising and off services like Yahoo Mail. And some people still have Yahoo Mail addresses.
I do, actually.
Alex Kratosky.
I do. It's disastrous. Something's happening with it, but that's a whole different podcast. But yes, absolutely.
But, you know, we use Yahoo Finance. I prefer to go, I'm a financial reporter, and I go to Yahoo Finance, but I've got to look up a share price or stats on a company. And she's done a lot to prioritise that and other little bits that are popular, Flickr, for example.
And we foreshadowed this briefly in the last bit of news, but Juliet, how much is the relationship with China a factor in the stabilisation rather than upswing, as you maintain?
Yeah, well, certainly US investors have bought Yahoo as a proxy for Alibaba's success, because you haven't been able to invest in Alibaba, you buy Yahoo. Until 2012, it owned 40%, let's not forget, of that company. Today, it owns just under a quarter. And after the IPO, people have been asking, well, will Yahoo's shares suddenly plummet? But in fact, Mayer is selling 40% of that quarter that they own. So it will still be a rather nice way to invest in Chinese e-commerce.
Follow that story at theguardian.com/technology. Okay, no offense to our male listeners. This is an all-female pod today, by the way. But it's time for the women in the room, all of us, to lean in. Why? Well, one of the most important figures in the global digital economy, the COO of Facebook, Sheryl Sandberg, has coined that phrase as a kind of shorthand for women in the workplace and in society to take control. Jemima, you had the opportunity to speak with Sheryl just last week. Tell us what happened.
Well, she's very likable, despite this observation she made that success is negatively correlated for women and positively correlated for men. And that is true. There's often a natural suspicion of successful women. And I think she's very much been a victim of this. Certainly, she wrote a book trying to tackle issues about women in the workplace. And it just shows what a vacuum there is around mainstream discussion of feminism, that loads of other stuff was sort of piled into that space because there was nobody else there talking about it. So, you know, isn't this a first world problem, for example, and you're not referring to traditional critiques of, of women based on feminist theory and all of these other things. And actually, she just wrote a very good book about how to assert yourself in the workplace and made a lot of very astute observations about that.
And arguably as well, she wasn't necessarily writing for women who were already quite high up in the workplace. I recall seeing when I was living in Los Angeles, seeing Lean In on the shelves of Costco, and it was flying off the shelves. So it wasn't a book necessarily for people who were already in technology.
Yes,
it was a book for, well, everybody.
Yes, because when she's at her most endearing is when she's actually at her most uncomfortable, which is when she's giving personal anecdotes like, her and her family were flying out on the eBay corporate jet, and she suddenly realized that her daughter had head lice and had to ask her daughter not to keep saying really loudly, "Mommy, my head's itching," and stuff. You know, and those little insights, you know, her admitting that, you know, even she thinks, "I wonder when I'm going to be found out, I feel a bit of a fraud," you know, it's really endearing. And I think it is reassuring, actually, to a lot of other women in work, which is what she was trying to tackle.
And here's Jemima speaking with Sheryl Sandberg.
If you ask people if they're a feminist, most will say no. If you define the word and say a feminist means you believe in equality based on gender, you get to a majority saying yes. I don't exactly know who are the people who say no once you put that definition in front of it. But it's a hard word because it's a word that a lot of people haven't identified with. It's a word that seemed to people that we were angry or undateable or unattractive. There are all these negative connotations. But the problem is that, again, we have still not gotten to equality. So, ready for this shocker? The world is still run by men. And I'm not sure how well that's going. But the numbers are really stark, really stark. There is not women have less than 6% of the top CEO jobs in every country in the world. They have 5% in mine and 3% in yours. I just came from France, where women have 0 of the CAC 40 CEO jobs. Women represent a minority in every government, in every nonprofit industry, in every industry. We're not getting women into leadership roles. And men are 4% or less of the stay-at-home parents, also in every country. And so our decisions are based on gender. They're not based on truly equal opportunity. And that's why we have to keep going. And as grateful as we are to the work of the women that came before us, our work's not done. And we owe it to them as well as to ourselves to keep going.
Okay. another thing that you've taken a lot of flack for is that you're trying to tackle equality, but from the position of somebody who's very, very highly educated, very wealthy, and a very privileged Western woman. You set out to tackle women in the workplace, but it feels like there was such a vacuum where perhaps the mainstream discussion of feminism was that, therefore, almost by default, you had to be responsible for, you know, for all of those other issues that aren't really discussed. Is that inevitable, that you'd be criticised for the bigger picture, the larger problems women face?
I'm not a historian, but I don't believe anyone argues for real change in the world and doesn't get criticized, because that's what it takes. Mm. If you are arguing that something needs to change and you're saying loudly and clearly and unapologetically, this isn't good enough, people are going to be on all sides of the issue. And I'm grateful for the debate around Lean In, grateful for all the debate on all sides, because the reason I wrote this book is the lack of debate. Something you and I talked about just a few minutes ago, the absolute acceptance. People just thought, oh yeah, women are doing great. And I'm looking around, and every year there are fewer women in the rooms I'm in, every year. And the numbers haven't moved in 10 years, and it's really worth understanding that. Women made all kinds of progress for a long time, for basically 3 decades, from the 70s. And then about 10 years ago, progress for women at the top of almost any industry, almost anywhere in the world, went completely flat. And anyone who's watched trends knows that anything that goes up for 3 decades and then is flat for a decade is not going up so quickly and might even go down. And so that needing to change is really important. And of course, people are going to criticize all things about it. My biggest fear is that we'll settle right back into complacency.
And so, only women view success as a barrier to giving advice, Gloria Steinem said. Is that fair?
I think her quote is, only in women is success a barrier to giving advice? Not only women view it, women and men view that of women. Okay. So one of the fundamental things we face, and it's interesting now for me because Lean In's been published in a lot of places in the world, and I've now been around the world. I was just in France, right? Everyone in France talks about how different their culture is. Everyone here talks about how different their culture is. Cultures are so different all over the world, right? From France to the UK to Japan to China to different parts of the US, except on gender. Where it turns out, no matter what our cultural, religious, socioeconomic, educational differences, our stereotypes of men and women are pretty much exactly the same. We believe, everyone believes, men should lead, men should be results-focused, men should advocate for themselves, women should follow, women should speak when spoken to, women should be communal. And so leadership for women comes at a cost. As men get more powerful, they lead, they're more successful, they're better liked in every culture. As women get more powerful, more successful, they are less liked by women and men. And that's because it goes against our expectations. It also goes to this book. This is why men can negotiate for themselves and pay no penalty. When a man sits across from a man or a woman and says, look, I deserve to be paid more, everyone likes him and they usually pay him more. And when a woman sits across and says, I deserve to be paid more, she is disliked. Even if she gets that raise, she doesn't get the next one or the next promotion. And so one of the chapters of this book, written by Kim Keating, who's a compensation expert, gives women very specific advice on how to navigate what is something pretty tricky.
How do you deal with that? I mean, you've had to have those discussions, those negotiations about pay. You've had to deal with the flak from a project that you're evidently very, very proud of. How does that affect you personally?
You know why you're doing it and you keep going. The real risk is the risk of complacency. I am not afraid of the debate, and I'm not afraid of the debate around Lean In, you know, the debate we sparked by our Ban Bossy campaign, the debate we have when we put ourselves on the table. What I am worried about is the complacency, what I think of as the tyranny of low expectations, and I'll give you an example. In the United States in 2012, so the most recent Senate election, women won 20% of the seats. Every headline in the United States, women take over the Senate. Women take over the Senate. They ran stories in every paper I saw about that there were actually a line for the bathroom in the Senate, the women's room, for the first time.
50%, we'll laugh about this in 20 years, I'm sure.
Well, 50% of the population getting 20% of the seats, that's not a takeover, it's a problem. And the fact that people were so pleased, and that we should be pleased with the progress, but it's so little and it's taken so long. And so the real risk is not active debate. The real risk is not criticism of anyone who speaks out. The real risk is that we'll settle on down thinking this is okay. And that's what I'm more worried about.
You wrote very compellingly in the book about how women internalize their kind of emotional challenges at work. To pick out just a few, because evidently we're quite good at this, guilt, feeling a fraud, the need to be liked. Do you feel those things? Do you still feel a fraud?
All of them. I mean, so I spent a year researching and writing this book. And the book, for those who haven't read it, tells women that they should feel more self-confident and own their success. So then I turn the book. And then we have this meeting at Facebook with one of our whole senior team. And there's a project that for years I really believed in. And the senior leader we have, Jay Parikh, he really believed in, and no one agreed with us. So for 3 years, we tried to get this project funded and done, and no one would do it. So we finally got together, and we agreed we'd do the project. So right after the book is turned in, I start the meeting, and I'm like, thank you all so much. I am just so grateful to be here because all these years, no one agreed with me, and now I feel so much better. Jay looks up. I knew Cheryl and I were right, and you'd all agree with us eventually. And I thought to myself, really? 3 years of disagreement? I'm more senior than you are. It bothered me. It didn't bother you. So late that night, it's like 2 months before my first book tour, I'm Facebook messaging with Jay. Jay, can I use that story on my book tour? Sure. Jay, can I use your name in that story on my book tour? Absolutely. He's such a nice guy. So I then write, Jay, don't worry, I'm not going to make you look egotistical. I'm not worried about that. I don't have Jay's self-confidence. My husband's here with me today. He's amazing, and
You do have the appearance, to be fair, of somebody with a certain amount of self-confidence.
But I think that's part of sharing my story. I don't think we walk around and walk up to people on the street or even talk to people we work with that often and say, I feel really guilty. Hi, how's your day? I feel really guilty I'm here today because my kid's sick at home. I feel that all the time. I don't say it a lot. We don't have an opportunity to share that. And so this was me sharing that and being honest about it with the hope that it would help me and everyone else get over it just a little bit. And what happened is other women added their voices. You have women like Bianca and Rosianna and so many others. There are hundreds of lean-in stories and some from men where people said, you know, I had something to overcome. Some of them did, some of them didn't, but they're sharing that and sharing that honestly. There are lots of times to this day, I still feel like I shouldn't be in whatever seat I'm in. And then I literally remember that if I were a man, I would think I belonged here. And if I were a man, I would think, rather than be grateful everyone agreed with me, boy, it took everyone a long time.
I slightly struggle with, although I recognize there is a truth there, I slightly struggle with the kind of generalization that all women lack self-confidence. So it can't really be that simple,
yeah.
Can it?
And I'm pretty clear on that in the book. And the data we cite is pretty clear. I'm not saying all women lack self-confidence. But here's what I am saying in the data shows. Relative to the same level of performance, when men and women perform at the same level on measurable things like grade point averages or sales quotas, everyone, including the individuals, remember the male's performance a little bit high and the women's performance a little bit low. It starts with crawling. Studies of mothers estimating their children's crawling say that mothers systematically overestimate their sons
and
systematically underestimate their daughters.
We've got enough of that.
But this is interesting, right? So the data shows that. The next thing the data shows very clearly is that when a woman succeeds, people and that woman ascribe it to working hard, help from others, and getting lucky. When a man succeeds, we ascribe it, and he ascribes it to his own success. So yes, relative to the same level of performance, men feel, on average, more confident than women. Not every man, but on average, and it's a very documented phenomenon. And you see it in the workforce. I mean, I was at Google when a lot of the original ideas for this book came. I had thousands of people that worked on my team. And women, I would sit there, not all of them, but a lot. You should take this job. You should apply for this. And they would say things like, I'm still learning in my current job, and I don't know if I can handle that. And the men were beating down my door for the opportunity they were sure they could do. Not every man, but many more. And I watched men and women who were performing at the same or sometimes the women was performing level with the man reaching for more opportunities for a lot of reasons. That's part of why I wrote this.
I think we'll have to make a pledge to act on this. Now, I know you hate questions about work-life balance. As somebody who's also a working mother, it doesn't feel like balance to me. It feels like cramming as much stuff into every day as possible, which is very stressful. You know, if you're woken up five times in the night with a vomiting child, as I was last night, you don't really feel you can completely give your all when you're at work for 12 hours. Shouldn't we all then be actually leaning back a bit? Don't we need to be a bit kinder to ourselves? Because your book is very inspiring, but it's also more pressure.
So I don't mean my book to be more pressure, and I think if you read my book fairly, my book does not say it's easy to over-characterize or over-generalize a title of Lean In. The book does not say lean in all day, stay at work 12 hours a day. In fact, quite the opposite. I write that I leave work at 5:30, I've cried at work, that I want people to make time for both. I think women do need more time and space, and the way we're going to get there is real partnerships at home, and different expectations at work. So women are getting squeezed on both sides. The reason I particularly hate, it's not that I don't hate the work-life balance question, I hate the have-it-all question. Let's do a little poll. If you're a man, please raise your hand if anyone's ever asked you how you have it all. I'll try another one. Raise your hand if anyone's ever said, should you be working? Should you be working? Men only. Okay, women, raise your hand if anyone's ever said, how do you have it all?
How do you do it?
Yeah, how do you do it all? Women, raise your hand if anyone's ever said, should you be working? So this is the crux of the problem. The crux of the problem is most women work and most women need to work outside the home to support their families. It's true in the UK economy. It's true in the US economy. So this myth of women can't have it all, which really means women can't have jobs and children, is absurd because women have jobs and children and have no choice. They have that just like men do. But we assume men can have both and we assume women can't have both. And women are getting squeezed on both sides. The working day is extending. And importantly, and I cover this in the book, we expect more communal activity from women at work. Women do the committees. Women do the favors. When a man is asked for a favor in the workplace and he doesn't do it, everyone's fine. He's busy. He's got stuff to do. When a woman is asked for a favor in the workplace and she doesn't do it, she suffers promotions and compensation. And when she does do it, no one feels particularly grateful because a woman is supposed to be giving to everyone else all the time. So women get squeezed in the office. Go back to your offices and look at who's on the committees. Look at who's doing the extra stuff that everyone benefits for, and you will see more women every time. Now go to the home life. Women in the United States, when they have full-time partners and they both work full-time and they have kids, do 30 to 40% more housework and child work. Housework and child care than their husbands or partners. Here it's 2 times. I was in Paris this morning, it's 3 times. I was in Japan this summer, it's 5 times. The numbers vary, but the story is the same. Women have 2 jobs and men have 1. And our partners don't do enough at home, which is part of why women are exhausted and feel that they can't give it all at work. What would happen if we really had real partners? If women actually had someone doing 50%? It would totally change a lot of the pressure women are under. And that's what needs to change. We will never get to equality in our workplaces until we get to equality in our homes.
I feel quite blessed with my choice of life partner at this point. Cheryl, do you really not call your daughter pretty anymore? We are allowed to call daughters pretty and beautiful, aren't we? As well as our sons?
We are. And I certainly, you know, my desire to have, you know, this fabulously gender-neutral home. Well, that went away once I had kids. Because I have a son, Dave and I, Dave's here. We have a son and a daughter. And our son literally will take any toy and, like, bash it on the head of the other toy. And our daughter will take a sword and it'll kiss the other sword by the time she's done playing with it. So there are innate, or something's going on, socialization. There are differences. And yes, I find myself saying to my daughter, oh, you look pretty. And then I think about the last time I said to my son, you look handsome. And it's not balanced. And so I try really hard. And the research shows this conclusively. Conclusively, we have higher aspirations as parents by early secondary school for our sons than our daughters. We ask our sons more forward-leaning, far-reaching, how are you going to change the world questions, and we talk to our daughters a lot more about their appearance. They just published this, Google published this, the Google searches on appearance for babies were all gender female. It's an amazing phenomenon, and it is reinforcing what we have. So no, I don't do it that well, but I'm trying.
A few examples of issues in the workplace you will have opinions on, no doubt. One is that there are some very high-profile examples in Silicon Valley right now of young women who have had relationships at work, and the young women never come off very well in those situations often. What advice would you give young women that, A, find themselves subject to unwanted attention, and B, people who just get embroiled in some kind of relationship in the office? What's your take on that?
Look, workplace relationships are a fact of life. It doesn't tend to work out well. In many ways, I think it's better to try to keep those things separate. And I think it's better for obviously everyone to behave appropriately. I worry more about something else that I think happens even more. I think what's happening even more is that people are afraid of mentoring young women. And again, the research shows this. So in the United States, a study showed that 64% of male managers are afraid to be alone in a room with a woman. You can't mentor if you're not able to be alone in a room with a woman. And one of the responses I got from my book, I got it a lot from people in the UK, I got a lot from people in the US, is men reading my book and saying, you're right. When it comes to the work trip, I don't take the woman, I take the man. And that's why he's getting promoted. Because he gets to go on the trips and he spends the time with me, or I spend more time mentoring the men because I feel comfortable. I think we need to make access equal. There are some men who are going to say, older men who are in positions of power, there's a story in the book. A man said, I'm not having dinners with anyone. I will have lunches and breakfast with anyone because he felt comfortable having that with women and men, but no more dinners. That's great. And there's some men or women who are going to say, I'll have dinner with anyone, but we need to put that issue on the table because no one talks about it.
But that's particularly and make access acute equal. In the tech issue, in the tech industry, that's particularly acute, isn't it? Because
not
it's
really.
So male-dominated, surely?
So this is one of the most common questions I get. And people substitute in different industries. In Wall Street, it's the finance industry, or in London, or the tech industry. It's all industries. Now, tech has a particular issue, which is there aren't enough girls and women going into computer science. But the numbers aren't that different in any industry. You can do the biggest range of, you know, the most senior execs to the highest. It goes from like 11% to 21. It's actually not that big of a range. Because the issue we have with women in leadership is every industry. the nonprofit industry. In the United States, 75% of the workers in the nonprofit industry are women, 75%. 21% of the big nonprofits are run by women. Same problem. And so this is not an industry problem. This is not a problem that can be solved on High Street or on Wall Street or in Silicon Valley. This is a problem of accepting and getting women into leadership roles.
You're very lucky to work with Mark Zuckerberg, who I think has been one of the most underestimated people in the tech industry. He's part of a whole new generation of talent that has taken a lot of other industries by surprise, but he's also from a kind of programmer era, and there's a very strong culture around that. Yet he's been very outspoken, very supportive of Lean In. Tell us about working with Mark on that and how you managed to get him on side.
I mean, I think Mark's been great about this. You know, we worked together for a long time, and it was funny, when I wrote the book, he read it, I guess, a year ago Thanksgiving, so a year and a half ago, when it was in a galley form, right when the galley came out, I gave it to him. And he read it over his Thanksgiving holiday, and actually his wife read it too. And they kept like calling me and messaging me over the course of the weekend as they read different chapters. And when I came back, Mark said, you know, we've sat next to each other at that point for 4.5 years. He said, there's nothing in this book I don't know, but it was still different seeing it all together. And he really supports what I'm trying to do. He's always supported what we're trying to do together at Facebook, but he really believes that talent development, getting more women into computer science, getting more women into leadership roles is really important, and he's happy to put himself and us behind it, which has been great.
And he's probably read the Harvard Business Review stats that having women on management increases the ROI of a business about 34% on average.
That's right. I mean, we know that diversity of all kinds increases performance. Mm. We know that economies grow faster when women go into the workforce. And so this is, you know, not just feeling good, but good business. One of the things I've been most excited about since Lean In was published have been the CEOs, and they're usually men, because most CEOs are men, who have jumped in and said, this is a critical business issue for my company. Mm. Given out copies of the book, started Lean In Circles, started conversations on gender, and said, I'm not doing this as a favor to you. I'm doing this because we want to be the best, and we have to get the best talent and keep the best talent, and that means women.
And if you're running especially a consumer web business, then a large proportion of your consumers are going to be mm-hmm. women. Yeah. There's some very powerful case studies in this book. We've heard from a couple of those already. What are the practical lessons that everyone in this room could take away? If you could distill three principles, what would they be?
Well, they're a little bit different for different phases of your life, but let's talk about the graduates edition. I think for people coming into the workforce, the book tries to give very practical skills in different areas. So I'll take one right now, which is finding a job. Mindy Levy, who's an executive coach, writes a chapter on finding a job with very specific advice. So for example, this is not your father's job search. Turns out that your online resume and your online presence matters as much or more than a paper resume you're going to send out. And people forget that. There was a huge percentage of new grads, even from the very best schools, have typos on their resume. That can cost you a job, particularly in this market, so check and check again. People expect you to know about them. When our fathers interviewed for jobs, there wasn't that much information available, so people didn't expect you to know. But when you walk into an interview today, these companies have put a lot online, and they expect you to know about them, about their industry, about what they've been doing. And doing that research is critical, and new grads don't always do it. Similarly, people are going to research you online. You should know what's out there about you, and you should be doing a good job making sure that you're putting forth the kind of persona you want people to see.
Also, there's a very good example in the book of when you met with executives who brought quite senior women assistants with them, and the women literally wouldn't sit at the table, even though you invited them to. I think I took that as a really simple example of how to just make a difference and bring women into the conversation. Just tell them to sit at the table.
I see this all over the world. Go back to your offices and look at this tomorrow. Relative to the same level at any company, more men than women sit at the center and the front, and more women sit at the side. And sometimes when I'm there, I see them walk in and they sit on the side and they're like, wait a second. And they literally are like, I need to sit at the table. She's here. Like, no, you need to sit at the table, whether I'm here or not. Another thing we talk about in this book, it's in Kunal Modi's chapter. He writes a chapter on millennial men leading in, is not only do you have to sit at the table, but you need to participate. So What percentage of time do you think women are the people taking the notes for the team? You cannot fully participate in a meeting if you're the one taking the notes. Now, sometimes you have to take the notes, but I promise that the person who's paying attention and contributing is getting promoted over the diligent note taker. And women too often either get put in that position or put themselves in that position as the diligent note taker. So be a team player, take the notes sometime, but sometimes ask other people to do it. And what Kunal says as a millennial man who's trying to lean in is that it's incumbent upon him to make sure that he's sometimes taking the notes, that the burden doesn't fall on women to do those tasks, the kind of tasks which keep them from really getting seats at the table.
If I was being really critical, I'd say that a lot of these issues are first world problems, and that if you really wanted to make a difference, maybe you would look at politics. You've been very outspoken in your support of Hillary Clinton before, mm-hmm. but why not go into politics yourself if you really want to help women in poverty, women who are struggling to get their kids good education, good health care?
We need women in all sectors. We need women in political office. We need women in business, which is what I'm doing, and I really love my job. I think it's really important that we don't create false trade-offs and we don't put too much burden on any one person, right? There's not really there's a false trade-off here between political action and individual action. We need both. There's a false trade-off between putting too much pressure on any one woman to represent everything to everyone, which we don't do to men, because each of us can only do one job. And the real issue is, how do each of us figure out what our dreams are? I love my job. And I love working on Lean In, so this is the right path for me right now.
Right now? But that doesn't completely rule it out.
This is the right path. No, and I've said this over and over again. I do not plan on running for a political office, but I do think I can make a difference in business. And I hope a lot of other women. There's a great story in the new book by Sarah Kurvovsky. She's a woman. She read the original book of Lean In. She was 28, 29 at the time, and someone had approached her about running for mayor of her town. She lives in Iowa in the United States. And she said, no, I can't do that. I'm a mother. I have two young kids. And then she read Lean In, and it occurred to her that if she were a father with two young kids and someone approached her about running for mayor, she would run. So she ran. She won. She became the first female and youngest ever mayor of Pleasanton, Iowa.
At 29.
At 29, with really serious plans to build a political career. So this can work.
I just wonder if people keep asking you whether maybe you should consider it.
I'm pretty happy where I am.
It's a very diplomatic answer. One last thing is that you rather beautifully described joining Google as a rocket ship, and you obviously made the right decision joining that. But the technology industry, there's a perception that there are loads of men in it, and as you've explained, that problem is with every industry. But there are yes, especially at the top. But there are huge industries, there are huge opportunities, in the technology industry that are amazing for both genders, but particularly for women. So I sort of wanted to take the opportunity to have this room full of amazing, interested, engaged women and say, if you want a really powerful, creative, exciting, very fast-moving career...
Flexible.
The technology industry is just calling out for people like you. So, you know, that it's the future.
And I'll put one plug in, which is computer science and girls. So women are getting 13% of the computer science degrees in the United States, down from 35% in 1985. Women are getting 18% of the degrees here. That's not enough. These are highly paid jobs that are booming, that are incredibly flexible. And anyone who thinks it's better, last summer, Dave and I put our 7-year-old at this 1-week computer camp at Stanford University, which is right near where we live, Silicon Valley. At 7, parents are deciding what you do. 35 kids, 5 girls. Of the 5 girls, we put 3 in because they were our niece and her 2 friends. And so anyone who thinks this is getting better and the stereotypes aren't self-perpetuating needs to wake up. Computer science for girls. Find the girls in your life, hand them technology, let them go. Let them play with games and stuff. It will help them. But we really need, as a society, to get more girls into technical fields, just like we need more girls in leadership and women.
Tech is no longer just one industry. It's a part of every industry. So it really is your key to your future. Cheryl, thank you very much.
Thank you all so much.
That was Jemima Kish speaking with Sheryl Sandberg. And you can watch an 8-minute video of Jemima and Sheryl on the website at theguardian.com/technology. But if you want to hear the entire interview, and it's an hour long, full of amazing tidbits and those embarrassing anecdotes that, as Jemima says, make Sheryl so endearing, then you can. It will be an extra podcast episode. So just stick around at theguardian.com/technology/techweekly. That's it for this week. I'd like to thank my studio guests very much for their participation in this week's podcast, Juliet Garside and Jemima Kish. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks. Yeah. Pleasure.
We're back next week. I'm Alex Kratosky, and the producer of Tech Weekly is Jason Phipps.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.